You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Thank you for being here and choosing this show as your show for the week. I'm sure you have other things to listen to and do in your life, but you've decided to stay with me for this 50 minutes, for this hour. It's nothing. You could do it. Ryan, welcome.
Hi.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too. How you doing?
It's nice to see you had a surprise party for your dad for his birthday for his 70th.
I did. Yeah. He was really surprised.
That's sweet. Twice. Well, that's what the surprise party's for. I told you I'd never had a surprise party.
I know.
Have you?
Is that you saying that you want a surprise party?
Well, no, but no one's ever thrown me one. I've always been a part of everyone else's surprise party.
I don't think
you
can ask for a surprise party.
I'm not. Anyway, thank you for listening. I ask you if you like the podcast, if you're really enjoying it, just subscribe. It really helps the podcast. And write a review. It really works with the algorithms and gets the show more popular. And if you want to give back to the podcast, our patrons save the show. They really do. They are unbelievable. Thank you all, patrons. Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com/insideofyou. Also, the Inside of You online store has Smallville scripts and ship keys, autographs, all that stuff. Go to the Inside of You online store. I'm on the Cameo, all that. You can go to sunspin.com for any band information or anything you want to buy there, or buy a Zoom with me and Rob. And on my link tree and my bio at the Michael Rosenbaum on Instagram, you can find all this stuff. So just go there. I am going to say a few things before we get into this incredible interview with an incredible guy. This is, I became very friendly. I worked with him, incredible to work with, very giving as an actor, and sitting down with him and talking to him. He's very open, and he's old school in terms of he says what he wants to say, what he believes, he doesn't bullshit you. And I really enjoyed having Vincent D'Onofrio, legend, if you ask me. He's done so much incredible work, and we talk a lot about it, and we'll get into that. First, I want to read something for you. Also, go to Monsterpalooza in Pasadena, October 13th, 14th weekend. Monsterpalooza, it's like horror stuff. It's totally cool if you like horror. But go get a ticket to that. It's awesome. I'm going. Guys, and don't forget, please come support Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum live at the Regent Theater, downtown Los Angeles, 8 p.m., October 11th. My special guest is Zach Levi. Zach freaking Levi, Shazam, Chuck, all that goodness. We're really excited. It's going to be a great night. It's my first live show, so I hope people show up. So get a ticket and come see me. It's going to be a great night. I also want to say that October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Did you know that 10 million women and men are physically abused by an intimate partner in the U.S. every year? For over 50 years, the Take Back the Night Foundation has been working to eradicate domestic and sexual violence in all forms. This month, I'm partnering with Take Back the Night to spread the word and help raise much-needed funds for them to continue their good work on campuses all across the country and in their global outreach programs. Please click the link. You can go takebackthenight.org for more information and donate and help for a good cause. Together, we can shatter the silence. Together, we can take back the night. All right. So just a few important things. And I also want to say I'm incredibly proud of my friend Shira Astroff and the Animal Rescue Mission for all the work they're doing and saving so many animals. It's an amazing nonprofit that I just adore. I'm on the board, and they work wonders. They're magical. I wish everybody had as big of hearts as they do. And Animal Rescue Mission, folks. It's awesome. All right, without further ado, let's get into it. Let's get inside of Vincent D'Onofrio.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Hey folks, wanted to highlight something important before today's episode. In case you weren't aware, myself and many of the guests are on strike alongside SAG-AFTRA and WGA. Today's episode and any we air before the strike ends were recorded before it began, so this is just a heads up in relation to some for the topics we may discuss. If you want more info on the strike, visit sagafterstrike.org. Now let's get into it.
I mean, I'm so excited. By the way, you really look good. I'm like, holy shit, you look just chiseled. You lost weight and you've been working the shit out, haven't you?
Well, I'm We're doing this particular thing. Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm training hard. Yeah.
Does it rhyme with fair fevel?
No, not at all.
You just can't talk about that at all, can you?
No. No, you just can't. Like, the only thing I can say is that it's a different show, and you know, that's it. I mean, it's really, it's like, it's terrible. It's like, that's the way things are these days. You can't discuss anything. And then everything I do say, even if it's something very subtle, people look into it the wrong way, and then it becomes this kind of news thing. And then it seems like to the rest of the cast and stuff that I'm out there talking about the show when I'm actually not. So
right.
It's
like, you don't go to a lot of cons, huh?
I had a change of feeling about them a couple of years ago. You know, I didn't like participating in much, you know, other than showing up on time at work. And, you know, but I have to say, though, you know, you make a little bit of money, and it's extraordinary. I had this thing happen where, I know this is probably very typical, probably has happened to you a million times, but it never happened to me before, where a woman came up, and it's a very simple thing. She said that her dad was ill, he was in the hospital, and that he's been a huge fan of mine his whole life. And we were about the same age. And, you know, and I asked her if I don't know, it just hit me heavy. And I asked her if she would, you know, you're not supposed to hold up the line. I asked her if she wanted to FaceTime him. So she did. And I won't tell you what he said specifically, but he said some very intense stuff to me about his health and about his welfare, and a particular thing about just this little insignificant part that I played in Adventures in Babysitting. I played Thor.
Wow. At the end, right?
Yeah, like I help them with their car.
Yeah.
And then I give the girl my winged helmet, you know.
Right, right.
That I kind of pull out of. Oh, no, she's dressed as Thor, and she gives me her winged helmet. Sorry. And because she believes that I'm Thor, and I'm kind of actually in the Adventures of Babysitting world, I am Thor. And so at least that's what I believe. Anyway, so he, you know, there was this little story that he told me about that, and about how men have trouble with their questioning their integrity all through life, you know, and how a lot of men suffer from worthlessness, even if they never admit it. And, wow. You know, women do too, obviously. But this particular story was about men. And that, for some reason, that hit him, that I would come off of Full Metal Jacket and play that little part in that movie and look completely different. And, like, he found that to be truly inspiring. How that kind of thing happens is beyond me, but... So, like, I've never, ever been in that position. You know, I sign autographs all the time. I don't shy away from that. If people want pictures, I do that. I've done that my whole career. I learned from Gregory Hines a very good lesson about that. Yeah. So I'll tell you what Greg taught me in a minute. But it was, you know, so I've never shied away from that kind of stuff. But I've never, because I do more television and films than I do theater, you know, like in 3/4 of my career is all theater. I mean, it's all films and television and very few plays. And so I don't get that kind of thing. You know, I don't get to hear what people think of these little parts that I played. And I've done a million of them because I always thought, I don't care like how big the part is. I'll go play it if I like it. If I help, I know this sounds corny, but, you know, anything to help service the story, honestly, that's really how I feel about it. And whether it's an hour or a lead or supporting role, like I do mostly these days, and or if it's a part that lasts 2 minutes in a movie, I love that stuff. And, you know, nobody ever keeps me from bringing in a full character, you know, like even if it's for 2 minutes, nobody says like, oh, no, you just got to come in and say the line. Like I'm allowed to do whatever I want, which I'm very fortunate, you know.
I think that stems from theater. Because when I'm doing plays, I remember back, it's sort of like this thing where, yeah, you do this little part and you play this, you put a hat on, you put a mustache, you put like, it's like what we love to do. And so you want to just, you don't want to be just like this. You want to kind of do a lot of different fun things.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly that. And so ever since then, I've had a completely different view about the Comic Cons. And so now I have a person that helps me with them, and I go whenever I can, you know, whenever it's not doesn't get in the way of my life and my job. But I go. But before that, you know, I didn't participate because I felt a little shy about it, and also, I mean, shy in the way like just personally shy about it. And I also felt I wasn't like. People weren't interested in my career in that way. But it turns out that all those little parts that I played, and I guess the bigger ones too, has affected people's lives. And that's just so sweet that you can't, I mean, that's just so sweet to me.
I feel the same way. And, you know, the impact that we don't even realize that we have on people, and you do a role that you feel, oh, that's insignificant. Like, no, and nobody might have even seen. There's movies that I've done that I, you know, do I wish I never did? Yeah, maybe. But they come and they bring something to sign. I'm like, oh my, you saw this? You were the one who saw this movie? And they're like, yeah, my dad and I, we love this. There's a connection. And hearing them talk to you about their connection and your connection, it just feels good. And, you know, before, you know, a long time ago, people would say, oh, you know, you're just taking fans' money. And I'm like, let me tell you something, okay? Because I thought about it in the beginning. And I came up to the conclusion that, you know, like I might want to go to Hawaii for vacation. These guys that go, and I used to go to conventions by myself before I became anybody. I was going to horror movie conventions with my dork friends. And like, you know, we didn't have any money getting like some guy from Dawn of the Dead to sign our picture for $5 or whatever. But this is their vacation, whether they cosplay or they come for the weekend, they're with their friends, they get a hotel.
They're definitely into it. They want to.
Oh, yeah. They're loving this. Don't feel bad for these fans.
Are you kidding me? They're so happy.
Like, I envy them. I envy the fun they have.
Well, yeah. I mean, there is no bad feelings at these things.
Yeah.
There is. You run into next to no negativity. Like, that is a rare place for entertainers to be.
Yes. Yeah.
And we are very lucky to be in those people's company.
Well, you also were talking about a minute ago, you tapped into it. You're like, you know, I'm kind of shy. But you've been dealing with shyness since you were young, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I read that you like, you know, you're always in your head. You'd be up in your room. I believe it or not, people look at me as an extrovert. And then I read somewhere where just because you do outlandish things and you're like funny and you're, it doesn't mean you're not an introvert. And I still have an anxiety with people, believe it or not. And I used to go to my room up for the weekends. I never went to a dance. I never went to high school, anything. And I used to borrow my parents' VCR, put it to my VCR and copy movies and just watch old movies and just sit up there. And I didn't have a lot of friends and I was the smallest kid. So I understand that. What were you, were you popular in school? Or were you just kind of, did you feel like you were an outcast?
No. Nobody knew me in school. Nobody knew me.
Nobody.
I very few people. I had a good friend, Elio Medina, a Cuban kid. Cause like I went to junior high, most of elementary, junior high and high school in Hialeah, Florida. So I had a few friends on the block, but they were pretty nasty people, pretty tough characters. And but my best buddy was Elio Medina. We ended up traveling across country together in a Toyota Corolla, I believe, right after high school.
Perfect.
We went from Hialeah to San Francisco. But I didn't go to my prom. I think I'm in I think maybe there's one picture of me in a yearbook. My, you know, my hair is like down to here. It's super curly, chubby little kid, you know, like some kind of like generic motorcycle shirt, not even like a brand, just a motorcycle, like with some kind of cartoon.
It's
like
funny. It's funny because I picture you, I have this image because, you know, you play tough guys and serial killers and all these different things. But I mean, obviously you play a lot of different stuff, but I always, you know, until I met you and we ended up doing a Dax's movie and we had a scene that was cut out in the beginning where I was like, oh my God, this guy's a fucking, he's hilarious. He's engaging. He's like, you know, he gives and takes and just, he's a listener. And it's, I just was like amazed by how cool you were. And I had this image. Vincent D'Onofrio was probably the guy in that movie, My Bodyguard, with Matt Dillon and
Adam Baldwin.
Adam Baldwin. And he's probably that guy who's kind of a loner, outcast, wearing that jacket, but can kick ass if he has to. Were you that guy or not as cool?
I was not cool at all, but I did learn fairly quickly how to defend myself because there was a lot of nasty stuff going on in the neighborhood. And so, but that was just sheer. And also, you know, I felt obligated to protect my older sisters for some reason. And so like, you know, and then so the, but the group that I hung out with, they were definitely troublemakers, you know, so I had to avoid most of it. I mean, I was causing a lot of trouble. The guy who saved my ass was my stepdad. He was a firefighter. When he came into our lives, he basically got me off the street. Like he basically did some things that my sisters and my mom never even knew about. Like, to help me out, straighten me out a little bit. So, yeah, like it, no, but yeah, no, I can be, you know, Dax and I are very similar in that way. Like we're idiots when it comes to, fighting and stuff. Like we don't think like it, like you, the best fighters are the ones that are not afraid of being hurt. You know, like that's the main thing.
Yeah.
You know, Dax is very much like that. And I think that him and I are similar in that way. You know, obviously we've grown up, but we, you know, for a significant amount of years now, but so that's a lot of that is, I guess all of that is behind us now because of our children and our relationships and stuff, but.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
You could tell that you bring that intensity. Like you say, you've grown up, you're married, you've got your life. You don't put yourselves in that situation, but there is that side of you that brings out the best in your performances sometimes that I see, that sort of angst, that sort of like dark side. And do you think that comes from those early days of childhood? Do you think that, do you still have those?
Like my good friends that are actors, they think I'm a little mentally deficient because I don't get nervous. And so like, I don't get butterflies. I think that comes from my childhood, but the stuff during performances, I mean, that's just shit that I'm conjuring up from my life for sure, but it's something that I have to bring forward again. And speak through it. You know, that's the way that I studied acting. That's the way I was taught how to act. you know, so it's, that's what I do when I do that kind of stuff. That's all about bringing up events and speaking the author's words through those events.
Yeah. Do you get upset with yourself? Do you, when you're not where you want to be in a scene, how do you channel that? Does that make you nervous? Are you thinking about, oh, I'm letting people down? Or are you just like, I'm just going to, I'm in, like you say, you don't get nervous. So you don't get even first day jitters. What, how do you, if you're not getting through a scene, if you're not feeling it, how do you do that? How do you work through it?
You fail. You just fail. And that's fucking great. I love that. That's, I mean, I know this sounds, it's a little awkward to be talking about because, you know, I'm not trying to come across as some kind of like dude that's impenetrable. You know, I'm definitely, you know, I'm definitely, I've been humbled many times in my life and still carry a lot of humility around with me from those events of, when I was extremely humbled, but I believe that if you're not putting your head out on the chopping block every time you walk out on stage or every time they say the camera's rolling, then you're not doing the best you can. You have to fail. I fail constantly every day.
Wow.
When I'm working, and I do not get nervous about it. No,
that is fucking epic. I wish that I could have that feeling. I have been moments where I'm so confident you could throw anything at me and I'm impenetrable.
Sure.
And then there's moments where I'm a little fucking boy and I feel like my dad's yelling at me and I'm embarrassing myself. And both those feelings are so extremes that I don't, you know, I strive for the excellence, but sometimes you don't fail on purpose, but you, sometimes, you know, I was talking to you at a con and I said something to you and you kind of laughed. You told me this little story when you were doing Law and Order Criminal Intent. Now, the first time I saw that, I had never seen Law and Order, and I was on the TV and I stopped because I like you and I started watching you and I go, what is he doing? What? I found myself, I don't know what happened, so captivated in the way you were delivering shit and the way you were just your manners. It was like you were putting it together like a real person, but so quirky and like, you know, like you would do these things where you're like, and the left hand, I'm just trying, you were like, I could see you thinking, the character thinking, like it was real. And I go, did they like what you were doing right away in the dailies in the beginning? And you were like, no. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, no, they didn't like it at all. I mean, they were worried about it. Yeah. I don't know what story I told you, but you know, I would save certain spots to pause and not speak. And that drove them crazy because, you know, but I was like, this is not radio. Like, you can stop talking. Like, it's okay to stop talking. And by the way, you could cut it out if you want, you know, but, it was until Dick Wolf got it. Like, he got it that people were into that weirdness, that the idea that I had the guts enough to just pause and not speak for a moment, while the room is full of actors and the camera's rolling. He thought that was exciting, and he was the one that gave me permission to do all of that stuff that I was trying to do. And because I used to block those Aria scenes were saved for me to block. Like, I would block them, and I never changed the word. Once the script was published, I gave some notes, but very rarely. We had great writers on that show, you know, like great writers.
Yeah.
And you know, for that kind of thing, they're brilliant. You know, they were brilliant. And But I wouldn't change a word, but I would block the scene. I would block the scene myself, like, because I had it all in my mind of how exactly the whole thing unfolds. And some of those scenes were 12 to 15 pages long, you know, and so of just straight dialogue. And we used to do them top to bottom, like a piece of theater. Like, we wouldn't stop and then do lines. Like, we would do it top to bottom. So sometimes it'd be like three, sometimes there'd be five people in those scenes coming in and out of the room and stuff like that. It was fantastic. It was a fantastic. And Kate Irby, who plays my partner, from Steppenwolf. I mean, she was so ready to give me lessons in that kind of work, you know, like amazing. And so yeah, that it made them nervous at first, but you know, once the companies like that start making money, their nerves go away. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I find that fascinating. But also the first thing that comes to mind, my listeners will know this, is how do you learn all those pages of dialogue every day? You're working constantly, Law and Order. You're not doing like 8 episodes a year on a streaming show. You were doing how many episodes?
22 to 23. Yeah.
How did you, I know, I mean, how did you deal with that?
Well, I would stay 3 scripts ahead. I only had one choice. I can only do that. There's the only way. So I was giving notes on one script that I had just read. The other script, the second script, I would be trying to figure out how I could actually, how to control my arc in it. And then the third one would be the one that we were performing at the time. And I was learning, scenes. I would stay 2 days ahead of scenes and still be studying while I'm performing other scenes. So it was like a lot of work, you know?
Yeah, because you had exhaustion. You collapsed on set like in 2004, right?
Yeah.
I mean, did you know that did you feel like this is going to happen? Like my body can't take this anymore. I'm so fucking tired. Did you feel it or did it just happen? What happened?
I just couldn't believe that we were working so much. I just couldn't believe that it was okay to do year after year. And, you know, I learned the hard way that it was okay, that that's the way the business was. And it's not like that anymore. The New York Times did an article about the hours, the television hours. And Kate and I were, you know, a main part of that article, like, because we were at the time averaging 16, 17 hours a day. And that you know, that they said that in that article, like, so it's like, but you know, it's like today, these days, it's like a fucking vacation. I mean, honestly, nine episodes a season.
Yeah.
You know, granted in network television, you make tons more money, but in the end, it ain't worth it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you do sell your soul in a way. You're like, you're risking your health.
Nasty. You get nasty. I was, you know, I got to a point where I was completely in my head and just had no patience for anything, you know, like the only people that I would give back to were the other actors and the camera crew. Everybody else to me was just in my way and taking up my time from getting home and going to sleep.
Wow. Did they ever have a conversation with you about that?
No, but I have to say though, having said all that, when I left that show, I was 10 times a better actor than I was before I went on it.
Wow. Why is that? Is it the intensity and all that combined?
Just my chops got so good. Like I was just my chops. I learned how to transition so much easier. You know, I was just used to doing film where you do story transitions or emotional transitions over like 3 scenes or an act, you know, but on television, you do transitions within a scene. You know, big ones.
Yeah.
And so to be able to pull that off was, you know, I think it does with everybody. It either makes you or breaks you, and you either end up coming in and doing one line cut, which a lot of people end up doing, or you master it and you become this like machine. Yeah, everybody does, obviously, not just me. And you leave a situation like that, like, you know, you're great at the technical aspect of your job.
Yeah. Nothing better than getting something from a job. Like when you leave saying, wow, I'm better. Like you said, I'm better now. All the hard work, all the shit, the exhaustion, the whatever, the in my head, pissed off, whatever it was, all that. prepares you for maybe something that you're not even aware of.
Yeah. I was sent this footage from a film I did in Australia when I was younger. I think it was like my fifth film or something. It was with Rucker Howard, Joan Chen, and myself called, I think in Australia, we shot it in Australia. It was called Salute of the Jugger. It was around Mad Max time. It was like around the third Mad Max time, like in that area. And it was like a post-apocalyptic movie about a team called that played this sport, fictitious sport called Jugger. And we went around in this post-apocalyptic environment, walking through the desert from stadium to stadium playing this game.
Wow.
And anyway, I recently saw an interview that was done on set. This is before Law & Order. This is like early on in my career. And I was like, what a fucking prick this fucking kid is. Oh my God. How did anybody, like, honestly, it's like, how could anybody sit next to this fucking jerk off? Like, oh my God. In this interview, I was like, I don't know what the fuck was going on in my head. I was like a penis with arms and legs. No fucking brain, just erect and ready. Just like stupid, like so stupid.
I've done that. I've been there. I know what you're saying.
So stupid and so, like, you know, embarrassing. Oh my God.
Well, but, that's all right. We do.
Well, of course it's all right, but it's like unbelievable to watch it. You see yourself and it's literally like a different person.
Yeah. You know, I wasn't going to ask you about this because you've answered every question. People have talked to you about it ad nauseum. But I do myself an injustice if I didn't bring up something about it. But like playing, and you can tell me if you even like talking about it, but playing Private Leonard Lawrence in Full Metal Jacket. I'm sure you've been asked everything. My only real question really is, it's so intense, those moments. And I just was any of that improvised? Was any of what he was saying improvised? He wasn't even an actor, right? What's his name? I'm sorry.
Lee Ermey,
who was brilliant in everything I'd seen.
Yeah, so what would happen was he was a drill instructor in real life, mm-hmm. You know, for many years after he, you know, this guy did three tours in Vietnam. He went back twice. He volunteered to go back twice.
That's a stud.
So he was there, you know, like for all the shit. He was in the shit for many years over there. And, you know, showed us his bullet holes and everything. And honestly, like the real deal. And, but he had an abundance from being a drill instructor and being around in that life his whole life, in that world his whole life. He had abundance of things to say. But Stanley, so he would just say them, spurt them out. And Stanley would then type them all out word for word. But then Lee would have to then do them every time. So he kind of dug his own grave because he was sort of at the time just barely an actor. And not to rate his ability, because his ability was amazing. But he had just, you know, he was green still. In my mind, he was green still. Even as a young man, I was like, this guy's green, you know. And and that was my first film. So like I didn't know any different. But no, there was no improvising. But, you know, so in a way, he was spitting out improvisations, but right. Not when the camera was rolling.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, because I remember watching the documentary on The Shining and, like, you know, Stanley's always typing on his little typewriter. And, you know, Jack would say something, you know, little pigs. And then he'd be like.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, he's like adding stuff.
Really hot. Yeah.
Yeah. Was he intense with you? Was he intense as a director because he wanted you to feel that or not at all?
No, he spoke very little. He didn't talk about story. Didn't talk about acting. Didn't talk about the scene. Nothing ever.
How many takes?
The most I did was 9. And that was for the blanket party when they put the soap in the towels and beat me up. We did 9 of those. The big scene, the big famous scene, they say the big famous scene anyway, it's you know, when I kill the drill instructor, yep. And I shoot myself. That we did 3 times. You know, and then we did an effect for the blood in the wall, and that was it.
What? I mean, all you hear is 100 takes, 90 takes, 50 doors.
Well, I'm not saying he didn't do that with other people, but not with us, not with Matthew and I. And and Arliss. Like we never Matthew Arliss and their team, when they were doing the Vietnam stuff, they got stuck behind that wall. There's a wall that they're behind before they go into the village right at the end when the sniper gets right at the end of the first act when the sniper second act when the sniper gets killed. Remember, all those guys get shot in that one little area. They were behind that wall for, I believe, around 4 months. So, and it was merely because of the way Stanley made movies. You know, he was very different than anybody I've ever worked with before. You know, if the light wasn't right, if the scene was flat, he wouldn't shoot. He just wouldn't shoot.
Did you ever see him angry?
Not like you mean like screaming and yelling and stuff? No.
Because you see it again in The Shining in the documentary. You see it. Damn it, Shelley, you knew it was there. Oh, come on.
Yeah. Well, they had a particular
relationship. Yeah. Some people say it was deliberate on his behalf because he wanted her to, you know, but I don't know if that's true.
I don't know what it was, but it was pretty, you know, pretty devastating for everybody, as so I hear. And no, it wasn't. But for me, it wasn't like I wasn't there for a lot of the Vietnam stuff. I was only there for the, you know, I was there in England for it, but I wasn't on set. I only went on set a couple of times. I won't say who, but I did experience. He came and he let me sit next to him. I was learning when they were shooting the Vietnam stuff. They shot that first. I was learning Monkey Patrol and marching, Monkey Patrol with the rifles, you know, the spinning and then the marching. And I was putting on the weight and learning all the how to take rifles apart. I was doing all that sort of like a pseudo boot camp, but without the boot, you know. Right. There was one day in particular I remember where just because I was, you know, Stanley Kubrick and I wanted to see him direct, you know, because I'd seen all his movies. And he came, he let me sit next to him during this one particular scene. And he had a megaphone. They were like, everybody was like about 50 feet away. And they did 72 takes. And this one particular actor did 72 takes.
How was the actor?
Every take, you know, Stanley would say, like Stanley had this thing where he would clear his throat. He would go before he would speak every time. And so over the megaphone, you'd hear like, it's take 69, so-and-so. Let's try to get it better. Click.
Like, what is the actor? I mean, what are you thinking? You're like, you're beyond embarrassed at this point. You're beyond like, is it me? Is it like, I mean, did you see some act? Did you, when you were on set, did you see any of the actors like that actor, like falling apart? Like,
falling apart's a big word. I mean, not happy. I mean, you know, not happy. You know, nobody's happy in those kind of circumstances. Everybody wants to get the day done. And I think that I think that was about a 2-day period. They stayed on that one particular actor until he got it right in Stanley's eyes, you know.
Did you ever talk to Stanley again? Was it at the premiere? Did he come up to you?
A couple times on the phone. There was no premiere, not that I know of. I mean, I certainly didn't go, but I don't do that kind of thing. But it's especially when I was younger, I didn't do it. These days I've gotten I try to be more civilized about it. But when I was a kid, there was nobody pushing me to do that kind of stuff. So I just didn't do it, you know. But we talked a few times on the phone. But nothing, we weren't like, I wasn't like best friends with him or anything. I know a lot of people say that they were, but I definitely wasn't. He helped me tremendously by just trusting me so much. Like he gave me one direction the whole time I was there. And it was a brilliant direction. And I was very lucky that we were on the same page. Like I was extreme. It was like Christmas.
What was it?
I've told the story a million times.
Oh, you have? Okay. I don't want to tell you if you told him a million times, but he gave you a direction that changed everything.
For that big night, he gave me an incredible direction before we shot it the next day. And it just so happened that you know, luckily I was thinking along the same lines. And so I went in the next day and we just did three takes and it was done.
How many times have you been on a set where you're just like, I don't like the director or I don't like the actor I'm working with? And is that really difficult? Do you have to sort of suck it up or do you let it, is it impossible for you not to just say, to show your colors? Like, it's fucking stupid. I'm not fucking doing it. I mean, you know, because I've worked with some directors that, I almost got in a fist fight with a director. I've told that story where I just charged him And but I was actually right in the moment, and everybody knew it. He was just absolutely belittling and degrading and pointing me out. It was the worst thing ever, and I just have never felt like that. And somebody just in the middle of it, like right before the camera's rolling, the AD goes, hey, just let's talk after this.
Yeah.
And the crane's coming down, and the girl I'm with her, like, are you okay? I'm like, no. And the camera's already coming in. We're talking, and I just beelined, and they grabbed me. And I was like, you don't fucking ever talk to anybody like that again. And it was just like, oh my God, I couldn't even, but I was scared because I never do that. You know,
it's hard to put yourself in any circumstance. It's like, it's hard to put yourself in a servant position if you don't respect the person. That's a very difficult thing to do. And I need to be in that position as an actor. I need to serve the story. Like, I want to serve the day. Like, that's, I feel like that's my job. You know, that's why I get paid, you know, to service the story. And so I need to truly be put in, I need to put myself in that position, you know, put me in my place because you're so fucking amazing and talented. Like, that's what I need. And it's very, very disappointing when that doesn't happen. It's very disappointing because you feel lost, you know, and then you have to start taking over, and it's not your job to take over. And that's a terrible position to be in. But, you know, I find that the men and women that I've worked with, the ones that are born directors, they're just, you can't imagine them doing anything else. You know, they never make you feel like that. They never make you feel like they don't have they're not steering the ship, so to speak, you know, and
right.
And then you feel totally like part of the crew and like, okay, let's go. I'm with you 100%, you know, and then I show up in the morning. I'm always on time. I'm always fucking prepared. And, I mean, we've worked together, you know what I'm like. I'm open and
yeah,
ready and, you know, whatever you guys want to do is okay with me, you know?
Yeah. But,
and I'm a bit of a smart ass at the same time. So
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's like, you know,
hey, what you know, see is what you get.
Like I have to say though, when I was younger, I had a lot less tolerance about this situation that I'm talking about not feeling like I'm in the right position, that the people that I'm supposed to be, that are supposed to be in charge are not talented. And that's, that when I was a kid, that used to make me, I used to get worried, and I would start to try to take over, and I would, you know, I would just take over. But I don't, you know, luckily, my career is very much under my own control. And there's been good things about that and bad things about it, but it is under my own control.
Yeah.
And so I put myself in situations 99.9% of the time where I'm working with extremely talented people, and I haven't felt lost in a long time. Now, when it comes to television, it's different because in television, the director doesn't have the same position,
right,
as it does in a movie. Like, it's a completely different thing. So you get used to there being 50-50. There's some amazingly talented ones, and there's some people that are just there recording the day, you know? And that's not very inspiring, but
yeah.
What the fuck?
Do you ever, have you ever been pissed? Because you're such a pro. You always know your lines. You like, once you walk on set, everything's behind you. This is, you know, you have everything under control, like you said. Have you had actors where you're working with them and they don't know their fucking lines and it's throwing you off and it's really pissing you off? And you said, learn your fucking lines.
I've taken some actors for walks. Yeah.
I'm glad you didn't take me for a walk.
Yeah. I'm very nice about it, but I've given... like lessons were given to me when I was younger in theater.
Mm-hmm.
I can give a lesson. I'll give a lesson out every once in a while.
Rightfully so. What would you say besides TV work? And obviously it was incredibly difficult, but what's the one role that you can recall in your career that was the hardest on you physically, mentally, the hardest part to play, and then the most rewarding? The rewarding part could be a different role.
Yeah, they're all different that way, though. Like, for instance, Law and Order was so rewarding because I was a better actor at the end of it, but it's definitely not worth the money. You know, the trouble it the pressure it put on my family and the pressure it put on me, and it was definitely not worth the money. And so I don't feel, the only reward I got from that was I was a better actor, which is a pretty good reward.
Yeah.
You know, the Full Metal Jacket was, will always be my favorite experience because it was my first experience, you know, in a real film, you know, like a, with a top director, like if not one of the best in the world ever.
Yeah.
I have to say the part that I'm playing now that I started on Netflix, the Daredevil show, is he's a crazy motherfucker, this guy. Like, he's so like real and emotional, and he's like a big baby and a fucking monster at the same time. And it's very, you know, we have on the Netflix show as well, we had the opportunity to put him in somewhat normal situations. He fell in love, he got married. In the new stuff we're doing, he's in normal situations as well. So the play, even in Hawkeye and in Hawkeye, not so much, but in Echo and in, which is not out yet, which precedes the new Daredevil Born Again show, he's in positions in, where, like he was in Netflix, where he's the same guy, but he's in a very normal position. And to play him in a normal position, like in a normal environment, like you or I would be in, is just batshit fucking crazy. It's like so fucking hard to do and so fucking crazy. And the shit that's going on in my mind when the camera's rolling is just fucking batshit stuff. Like, honestly, like I've get to the point where
I cannot wait to see this, man. Do you like when you're rehearsing it, do you rehearse it in a room where there's nobody else and just kind of lash out? Do you have a somebody you read the scenes with and really give it all? Or are you just quiet about it and do your own thing and figure it out on set?
I have a plan, and then most of that plan goes out the window. This is very normal, right? That's always happens with the actors, as you know. And so, but I have a huge, I always have a big plan coming in, and I don't push it on anybody. If I feel like the blocking is throwing the scene off, and we're pushing against it and pushing, I'll just stop and I'll say, I don't know if everybody agrees or not, but I just want to put something out there. We're pushing up against the blocking in the scene. We need to change the blocking. And then it's like a breath of fresh air. Like, everybody's like, oh, fucking thank God. Like, yes, let's change it. And then we change it, and then the scene starts rocking, you know? And, you got to have guts to do that. And I learned from the best that you have to have guts. Some of my peers are amazing at stuff like that. And like Ethan Hawke, Ethan's in search of the scene constantly. And if you're pushing up against it, like he says right away, no, like, let's just, you know, like, this is not right. I've been in scenes acting with him that he's done that. And he's been in scenes acting when I've done it. And I've been directed by him. And so you have to be there. But no, I stay very, very calm, even if, but just before, you know, because we've been on sets for a long time and we know when you're about to roll. Like, I get a sense immediately, my radar picks up. I got 5, maybe 10 minutes here before we start roll. And that's when I go in. So the action doesn't really mean anything to me. I'm already in by the time the director says action. I'm there. So wherever I got to be, I mean, I can get ferocious on set. Like, I can be ferocious and loud and emotional, and like, I don't give a fuck what people think, like, honestly,
because you're getting into it. You don't give a fuck.
I don't give a fuck whether it's crying or screaming or laughing or whatever the fuck it is. You know, crews are taught not to put their hand in the cage anyway. I mean, so what the fuck, you know? And
I so love this, man. I love it.
You know, and I just go I go all the way. So by the time action is said, I'm right when action, I'm there with dialogue. Boom, I'm in, like, totally in.
I love it. Wow.
But most of the time I spend on set is calm and sociable, and I'm just, you know, listen,
you're passionate.
Kids,
you're
it's
passionate.
About the homework. You know, it's about your homework.
It is.
If you do your homework, if you put in the time, learn your lines and do your homework, figure out the scene, know where you were, know where you are, know where you're going. If you've done all your fucking analysis of the story that you're telling, then you can show up at work and have a great fucking time. And then when you know the camera's going to start rolling, you go where you need to go.
You hear that, actors? Do your fucking homework. Me included. Yeah. Sometimes I haven't done my homework and, well, I fail. You know,
it's
what?
Not I, bad.
I would have loved to have seen you in Of Mice and Men. You played Lenny, right?
I've played him, but not where anybody would see it. Yeah.
No, like, back, like way back. This was back in the day, right? When you played in school. But I kept thinking of you. Like when I read that, I was like, oh my God, I'd love if he did Of Mice and Men now. Like I love Malkovich.
You know why I never got the chance to do it?
Why?
Because when I was the right age to play that part, it was a popular play. They were playing it everywhere and all the movie stars were doing it. And I wasn't enough of a name or to get that part on a big venue ever. And that's why I never got a chance to play it, which was fine with me because I went and saw all the productions of it. And I saw, you know.
If it came back now, would you do it?
I'm too old to do it. Too old for the part.
Yeah, because you have to be like in your 30s, right?
No, when I was 30, that part was being played all the time. It was even at Lincoln Center. And like it was like amazing productions I saw of it. Even in England, they used to do it. It was like amazing.
Wow. I would just love the chance to see you go. Do I get to tend the rabbits, George? I just fucking want to see that, man. All right. Well, I don't think you're too old.
We did do it. My in the American Stanislavski Theater, which is where I studied for half of my studies, and then I was at learned method acting after that. But with a woman named Sonia Moore had a theater group, and I believe I did the play somewhere in those years along and during that time. And we were a little young for the parts, me and my friend Steve, but we did it anyway.
What makes you laugh? Like, who do you find funny as a comedian or an actor that you're like, this is funny. This guy makes me laugh.
You mean in real life or in their work?
It could be both.
Well, Chris Pratt's a funny fucking guy.
I love that guy.
Yeah. I mean, Dax and I can make each other fucking laugh. Dax is funny as shit, you know. And we have the same kind of weird sense of humor, and it's very, I find him hilarious. And his wife, Kristen, just, and, you know, she just makes me fucking laugh like crazy. And they also send me basically stupid shit all the time. Two of them sitting, you know, before they go to bed at night, and they have this idea about my life or something, and they'll send me this text that they've sorted all out. And they've even written stuff out about my family tree and stuff. It's so fucking funny.
If you have you ever heard of Wilford Brimley?
Do I know who that was? Yeah. No,
do you know that? Have you heard his impression, Dax's impression of Wilford Brimley? Oh, it's really. In fact, I just hold on. You know, he played a clip of me on his Paul Rudd episode. So I'm gonna fucking.
It's gonna be a record cold winter this year. So when your little ones come in cold from building a snowman, warm them up with an extra thick bowl of Quaker Oats. It's good. It's wholesome. It's goddamn American.
Just ridiculous. This is awesome. All right, look, I'm going to quickly get in. This is called Shit Talking with Vincent D'Onofrio. This is my top tier. It's rapid fire. So it's top tier patrons. I love you. You guys support the show. Thank you so much. Patreon.com/inside of you. Mike F., what has been the role that you found to be the most fulfilling? You said the first one, pretty much, Full Metal Jacket, right?
Yeah. And then I would say The Whole Wide World was at that time the most emotional journey arc that I played in a character. So that was fulfilling as well.
Lex says, The Cell is one of the most underrated psychological thrillers and visually stunning. Do you have any behind the scenes stories or a favorite memory from the filming? You were terrifying. People, if you haven't seen The Cell, I can't even describe it. It just goes to a place where you're like, I remember going, like I felt like my body was just, it wasn't good.
Arsène Danois directed that. And I've worked with him twice. We also did a version of Wizard of Oz called Emerald City for NBC, which was one season. And it was that just to work with him. He's an amazing visual artist. And anyway, so he wanted me to do that. He wanted me to play that that part. And I had just done like Salt and Sea, and I played some other kind of weird killer guy. And I was like, you know, I'd rather just play some kind of normal dude. and he was like, no, you should really think about doing this part. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think I will. It's happened a couple of times in my career. And the director convinces me. And Hal Tarsem, I believe it was him that sent me the tape. He was a commercial director. He hadn't done very much stuff. He did The Fall, I think, already, which is a whole other story I'll tell you about someday, but how he actually made that. But anyway, so he sent me a commercial that he made. So imagine you're looking down at a blue tile floor. You're about 20 feet above. The shot never moves. It's just composed perfectly. All you see is blue tile. You're about 20 feet high. Camera never moves, never zooms in, nothing. A guy walks out in robes, tattered robes, you know, it's got that kind of Middle East kind of feel, just blue tile, carrying a bucket of water. He walks out. So you're just looking down on him as he walks out, and he puts the bucket to the right of the center. He walks back out. He comes back in, pulling a goat by a rope, walking a goat in. The goat walks to the middle of the frame. He drops the rope. He takes out a fucking knife and cuts the rope. This is all really happening in real life. He cuts the goat's throat. The goat falls over. The blood comes out of the thing. The guy picks up the bucket of water and goes like that and washes the blood across the blue tile, the red blood, and it says Travel Asia. There's a commercial.
What?
And I'm like, I called him and said, I'm in. I'll do it.
Oh, my God. And it was a real goat?
Yeah.
So you knew this guy's vision was going to be.
He actually shot it, by the way, there on location in India. Like,
jeez.
So it's not like he did it and he killed a goat for like a movie. He killed a goat because they killed goats, many goats a day.
Oh, my God. Stone Age, how was your experience with filming The Magnificent Seven, rapid fire, and was there anyone in that amazing cast who you had never worked with before that you really look forward to working with again?
Yeah. No, like every one of those guys were fucking brilliant. Denzel's amazing. Obviously, he's like one of the best.
Oh, actors. Yeah. Wait a minute. I do know that one.
Yeah. Chris is in that. And I wrote by then. Ethan's in that. I made really good friends with Manuel Rufo, who is now in Lincoln Lawyer, stars in Lincoln Lawyer. He's amazing. And Martin Sensmeyer, who's the most handsome actor in the world. He's this Native American kid who's, his talent is growing and growing and growing. He's going to be a huge star, I think, Martin. It was so much fun. It was unbelievable. We had way too much fun to get paid for. Like, it was so much fun.
I love that. Kristen B., last question. My son Caleb's a huge Jurassic World fan. What was it like working with animatronic dinosaurs in the movie? Any funny behind-the-scenes stories you can share?
Yes, there is. So they had these guys walking around in little leotards. They were like a little dinosaur dance troupe. Yeah. And so there's a scene and they were very serious about it, and I'm sure very helpful. But there was a scene where I had to get sort of eaten. And one of the raptors come in and kind of pin me against this wall. And I couldn't do it with those guys. I couldn't do it with the little guys, the leotard guys.
Did you yell at them? Get them out of here. Get them out of here.
Well, I was just like, I can't. Like, can you just, like, you have a dinosaur head you can stick on it? And they did. And they put the dinosaur head the same size as like the actual animatronic raptors, so they put it in the stick, and I acted to the guy, to the head of that, so it was much easier. But I couldn't do the dance troupe.
No,
do
it. You do any impressions?
No,
not one impression.
No,
I bet you could do a really good. It's different, a lot different, but in the cadence of a John Malkovich. I guarantee if you watch in The Line of Fire, when fucking Eastwood goes, you have a rendezvous with my asshole, motherfucker. I guarantee if you watch Malkovich go, no, what you couldn't possibly know, Frank, and he does this thing. I guarantee you could fucking kill it.
I'm not you're much too talented for me. I can't. There's no way I could.
You don't do any impressions.
No.
You were never that guy growing up, like memorizing quotes, or did you ever do that? Like, what was your favorite movie growing up?
My favorite movie. You don't want to know my favorite movie was
Willy Wonka.
No, actually, it was a much more deeper, intense film than that. It was Midnight Cowboy.
Oh, wow.
On Schlesinger film.
Great film.
Wait.
That's where he says, I'm walking here, right?
Yeah. But no, I don't do, I'm not, that's not like, that's not my, I'm not talented in that way. I'm barely talented. Like, I'm like right on the fringe.
You have a children's book. You sing. People, I mean, you're an actor, director, producer. You teach at Strasburg Method. Like, you do a lot of shit, man. But you can't do impressions. So I got one on you, bro.
Yeah, man. I like the Malkovich you just did. That was pretty fucking good.
Thanks, man. That, I like I said, I never left the house when I was a kid. So I do tons of impressions. And that's what I, you know, that's kind of.
Yeah, now I can. I'm good at doing, like, I'm good at producing you like. I can change postures. I can do accents. I can do all that stuff. Like I can create something that seemingly has never been seen before. Seemingly. Because it's all really variations on variations. It really, but I can do stuff that people think they've never seen before.
I always say you're one of my favorite actors. You're one of the nicest guys in Hollywood. I really believe, I can't believe you have it yet, but you're going to win an Oscar someday, whether you like awards or not. Nobody would be shocked if Vincent D'Onofrio won a fucking Oscar. Yeah, and the winner is, oh, that's about fucking time. Wait, he hasn't won one?
I think I'm in a different business than that. I honestly don't ever see that ever happening.
What?
Like, I just don't see it ever happen. Well, I always have the same answer, which is this exact answer I'm telling you. I just don't feel like I'm part of that circle. Like, I have some amazing friends in this business, men and women that are incredible artists. And, I just don't feel like, you know, that I'm, you know, allowed into that circle.
Really. But I will say, whether you think you're part of the circle or not, I never thought I was part of any circle. I'm like still the kid up in the fucking room. But I believe that sometimes you do something and that leaves no choice for those other people outside the circle than to recognize something that everybody obviously recognizes. So with that.
Yeah, it would be a raise. I'd get a bump in my pay if that happened.
But also your career would go downhill because once you win an Oscar, you know the story.
Yeah, and how boring is that? Like, to actually get an award for acting? It's like, really? It's not like Daytona 500. You know what I mean?
I want to know where you would keep the award, though. If you got an Oscar, be honest. Don't be like, where would you keep that Oscar?
It most likely would go somewhere. It wouldn't be out on a shelf, that's for sure. It would go in the, we call it the GIMP room.
Bring on the GIMP. Why would it be the GIMP room? What's the GIMP room?
It's just a room in the house where like all the crap is in there. It's like from a Tarantino movie, like kind of thing. Like it's just like a, like that's where all the nonsense it stays. It's not, it's in boxes. It's not like a beautiful room. It's like, just like, there's like boxes of stuff. Every once in a while, my daughter will go in there and straighten it up for me or something. It's like, it would go directly, most likely into the, it's either that or one of my sisters would grab it or something.
All right. Well, if you win an Oscar someday, you got to promise me to take a selfie. You'll take a selfie picture with it and send it to me.
I'll take a selfie in the GIMP room.
In the GIMP room with the Oscar. Yeah. This has been awesome. I'm not taking any more of your time. I love you. This was honestly incredible. I love talking to you. Hopefully you'll come on again. I hope it was easy and not bad.
That was so easy, dude. Thank you, man.
Thank you. You rock, buddy.
Thanks, dude, man. I appreciate it.
I'll see you later, man. Legendary, man. I mean, that interview was just, you know, sometimes I forget that I'm just like a fan. Sometimes I'm a fan. Now I've gotten to know him a little better, so I don't feel as much like a fan, but like initially when you meet someone that you're enamored by or you love their work, it's kind of exciting. It's like, you're a little nervous, and he can be intimidating, but he's also hilarious and friendly and giving. And after spending a few hours with him in Salt Lake City, I really love that guy. Vincent, thanks so much for doing this. I appreciate it. Hopefully you'll come back. And by the way, any of the stuff I talked about, cameos and Inside You online store and all that stuff, you can go to my Instagram at the Michael Rosenbaum. Go in the link tree. Everything's there. So you could do that. And don't forget, October 11th, 7 p.m. or is it 8 p.m.? I have a live podcast. Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum is live downtown Los Angeles at the Regent Theater. You can also go on my Instagram at the Michael Rosenbaum, the link tree, get tickets. Zach Levi, Shazam, Chuck, the list goes on. He is going to be my guest. It's going to be a fun night. Get tickets. There might still be meet and greet tickets for the show beforehand, so do that. All right. Without these top tier patrons, Ryan, the show wouldn't be. We love our patrons.
That is true.
Patreon.com/InsideOfYou. Become a patron. I'll write you a message. And there's so many perks, so many fun things. It's like a family. Become one. Let's do it. Nancy D. Leanne Kristen. Little Lisa Yukiko. Yukiko. Jill E. Brian H. Hinnenkamp. Nico P. Robert B. Jason W. Sophie M. Raj C. Always got something to say, that Raj. Joshua D, Jennifer N, Stacy L, Jamal F, Janelle B, Ashley Ryan, Mike E, Eldon Supremo, 99 more, Santiago M, Chad W, Leanne P, Maddie S, Belinda N, Dave H, Sheila G, Brad D, Ray H, Tabitha T, Tom N, Talia M, Betsy D, Angel M, Rhiannon C, Corey K, Deb Nexon, Michelle A, Jeremy C, Brandy D, Joey M, Eugene and Leah. I haven't seen you in a while. I want to see that kid. Corey, how are you? Angela F. Mel S. Christine S. Eric H. Shane R. Andrew M. Amanda R. Jen B. Kevin E. Stephanie K. Jorel. Jammin J. Leanne J. Luna R. Mike F. Stone H. Kayla. Stay Wild, Moonchild. Brian L. Kendall L. Kara C. Jessica B. Kyle F. Marisol P. Kaylee J. Just talked to Kaylee. Brian A. Ashley F. Marion Louise L. Romeo the Band, Veronica Q, Frank B, Jen T, Nikki L, April R, Derek N, JDW, Calm Bomb, Ginger, Insomniac, Rachel D, Lorelei L. We love you. Thank you so much. From the Hollywood Hills in Hollywood, California, I am Michael Rosenbaum.
Hi, Brian Tez. I'm here too.
Brian Tez is here. We love you guys. And thanks for listening. And I appreciate you. Be good to yourself.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band and they must think this kid must have just been handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.